Done.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. The world is on notice. The United States is rethinking or has rethought its nuclear arsenal. Weapons that form the backbone of America's Cold War defense may be called upon in the administration's war on terror. Certainly as a deterrent, always as a deterrent, but perhaps also as punishment for nations that pursue the development of weapons of mass destruction. What's called the Nuclear Posture Review was, according to National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice, selectively leaked out over the weekend. And it's either a big change in weapons policy or hardly a shift at all, depending on how you view it. Here's Condi Rice on Meet the Press Sunday.
No one should be surprised that the United States worries a great deal about the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, that we are going to do everything that we can to deter their use against American forces, American allies, or American territory, and that it has been longstanding American policy that the president reserves his options in determining how to respond should some state threaten or should some state use weapons of mass destruction against us. The only way to deter such a use is to be clear that it would be met with a devastating response.
The phrase devastating response, does that sound familiar? President Clinton used the same words to warn Saddam Hussein about his country's weapons program. But Vice President Dick Cheney says there is new thinking in the latest nuclear posture review. Operational weapons will be reduced as previously announced, but they won't be destroyed. They'll simply be wheeled to the storage shed. And Cheney says the Pentagon is sharpening its list of targets.
We also, in that study, direct that the Pentagon take note of and consider the possible threats to the United States from those nations that are seeking to acquire weapons of mass destruction.
The list includes Iraq, Iran, Libya, Syria, North Korea, along with stalwarts China and Russia. Connection listeners, the United States spends a lot of money on its nuclear arsenal. It is the essence of American military power and deterrence. But should the Pentagon be more flexible in considering targets and reasons for using nuclear missiles? Or should the weapons of devastating force be moved off the table altogether? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me for today's program, Bruce Blair. He is president for the Center for Defense Information, an independent military research organization based in Washington, D.C. He joins us from our NPR studios there. And Jan Lodal is adjunct senior fellow at the Council of Foreign Relations, former principal deputy undersecretary of defense for policy in the Clinton administration. He joins us on the phone from McLean, Virginia. Bruce Blair, I'll begin with you because I'm interested in hearing you nail down what you see as the principal change in what we're hearing of this nuclear posture review.
Well, Dick, it's a continuation of a trend that's been underway for a number of years that loosens up the rules that we impose on ourselves for the use of nuclear weapons and makes those rules more permissive so that we can threaten or use nuclear weapons under a wider array of contingencies against a wider array of countries. So this is a process that's been underway really since the Clinton administration. I think President Clinton accelerated it in 1997 when he issued his own nuclear guidance, which was secret, that restored China to the nuclear war plan after it had been not in the plan for almost two decades, and which in that document raised the a point that we should expand the role of nuclear weapons to deal with non-nuclear threats.
But Bruce, let's talk about it as a moment for those of us who don't follow it as closely as you and Jan. All my life, I've had the sense that the American nuclear weapon would never be used unless another nation had already pulled the nuclear trigger. And what we're hearing, not just floated from policy think tanks, but from the administration, is that there could be circumstances under which the American nuclear weapon would be used first.
Well, that's not exactly true, Dick, because we had special rules for the Soviet Union, and we were prepared to use nuclear weapons first to defend Central Europe from a conventional or non-nuclear Soviet invasion of Europe. We did, however, have we developed a rule called a negative security guarantee to other countries which were non-nuclear, in which we assured them that we would not use nuclear weapons against them if they were in good standing with the Non-Proliferation Treaty and did not ally themselves with a nuclear country in an attack against the United States. So this policy that's been evolving during the Clinton and now Bush period run against the grain of that assurance and now raise the specter of the United States using nuclear weapons first against a non-nuclear state.
Jan Lodl, could I hear your thoughts on what we're hearing now?
I think Bruce expressed it quite quite precisely. The biggest change since the end of the Cold War has been the elimination of any need to threaten a massive first use of nuclear weapons against a Soviet invasion. But Bruce is correct. There has been a loosening up, if you will, of American policy, moving away from the negative pledges that he cited with regard to non-nuclear powers. On the other hand, there's many other things in this nuclear posture review, some of which I think are good, but some of which are probably more problematic than even what the press has focused on recently, since the focus has been on this loosening up, which Bruce points out has been underway back into the Clinton administration. But this nuclear posture review leaves a very large number, in my opinion, excessive number of weapons in the U.S. arsenal for much longer period of time than are needed. And overall, just represents way too much emphasis on nuclear weapons as part of United States national security strategy.
Jan Lodl, why does it matter how many nuclear weapons there are? Whether, and I know there's a proper answer to this, but you know whether it's 5,000 or 6,000 or 2,000 or 1,700, that takes us back to the Cold War time of mutually assured destruction. And if the administration is changing its policy, saying, yes, in fact, we'll take them out of operation, but we won't destroy them, how does that change this country's nuclear posture as it's seen here and by our allies and enemies?
Dick, I'm going to first resist the temptation to argue with you about what mutual assured destruction was and wasn't. It never was a policy. But let me go directly to your question, what does it matter? It matters particularly in a world in which we intend and probably will deploy some ballistic missile defenses, because if we retain very large offensive forces and if we retain the so-called damage-limiting strategy, which I believe they have retained in their posture review, we will actually end up, as the Russian forces decline inevitably, for the first time since the beginning of the nuclear age, with what's called a first strike capability. And this will give us absolute military dominance over all powers in the world, and the kind of pressures that we're seeing already from other powers because of our dominance, our predominance in many areas, will just increase, and the United States will simply not be able to put together the kind of cooperative coalitions we need to deal effectively with the terrorists and the new threats of weapons of mass destruction.
So the type of flexibility, the adaptive strategy that the administrations, successive administrations, Bruce, have been talking about, I mean, in one sense, it's not a change. In another sense, if they're actually considering the construction of a new type of nuclear missile, smaller, more specific, more precision, the bunker busters, call them whatever you will, I mean, isn't that somehow turning the page in the nuclear history of this country?
In some ways it is, and some it isn't. We have some of those. We've always developed some of those. We don't need any more. It would be turning the page to develop these new weapons in addition to the very adequate capabilities we have today to deal with these potential threats and add emphasis to the nuclear side of our military capabilities. We don't need these. We should be emphasizing moving away from nuclear capabilities. I suspect Bruce and I agree completely on that, and that we should be improving our conventional forces' ability to deal with these kinds of threats so that we have less need to even retain the tiniest bit of nuclear reserve, if you will.
Bruce Blair.
In some ways, we're turning the page all the way back to the 1950s, Dick. When we first confronted this strange country that was the original rogue state, the Soviet Union, and decided that we were not going to have normal relations with this country because it was abnormal, we pursued every possible instrument of military and economic and political power under the sun that we could imagine. We pursued first strike options. We pursued a deterrence based on second strike. We pursued missile defense, air defense, civil defense, or homeland defense, if you will, until we finally realized that none of these things, except for deterrence based on second strike, would really work. We've turned the page back to the 50s and are thinking about these other countries that we regard as rogue states. And to some extent, China also falls into this category. We haven't quite figured out whether it's closer to Russia or closer to North Korea and Iran and Iraq. But our thinking now is that since we're not going to have normal relations with these eccentric states led by people with twisted minds, that we would pursue everything under the sun. That includes missile defense, national missile defense, justified on the basis of largely on the basis of rogue state ballistic missile threats. It includes certainly a deterrence and first strike and preemptive options. We're now looking at new weapons that we may need to have in our quiver in order to take out a biological weapons factory that Saddam Hussein may have built deep underground. It's and so on and so forth. Homeland defense and civil defense are all related to this complex in which we are really not clear at all about how to cope with the threat that these countries pose.
But are you buying this, Bruce, this idea of going back to the original attitude that the United States had when it was arming itself for the beginning of the Cold War?
No, I'm making an observation, and I'm just suggesting the state of immaturity in
right.
our way of thinking about these other countries. We have little moments of pique and irritation in our relations with a lot of countries, and our immediate reaction often is to think, at least in the inner precincts of the nuclear planning community, of how we should develop nuclear weapons to deal with those countries. So you remember the hostage crisis with Iran in the late 70s and President Carter? We started targeting Iran after that, with even with strategic missiles. Then we had a Desert Storm with Saddam Hussein. We started targeting Iraq with nuclear weapons. We had a little difficulty with China in 1996 when they started to fire missiles over the in the area of Taiwan to send a signal to Taiwan about its presidential elections. And the next thing you know, President Clinton has signed this guidance, which I think Jan Lodal probably signed off on, that led to putting China back in the war plan. So we have a lot of trouble figuring out how to relate to these countries other than with nuclear threats. And it's leading us to think along the lines of developing new weapons, even to begin to resume the testing of nuclear weapons in this connection.
New weapons connection, listeners, new testing of weapons. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Could it be that the best defense for the years ahead are a good nuclear offense? 1-800-423-8255. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio News.
This is W.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, and we're talking about the latest deals of the latest nuclear posture review, something that the lead editorial in the New York Times today says that, in reference to this, most thoughtful Americans believe that nuclear weapons should be used only when the nation's most basic interest or national survival is at risk, and that the unrestrained use of nuclear weapons in war could end life on Earth as we know it. Nuclear weapons are not just another part of the military arsenal. They are different, and lowering the threshold for their use is reckless folly. If you read the overseas newspapers today, you see that many allies and enemies of the United States are reacting in much the same way. The foreign minister and the defense minister from Russia are saying that what they're hearing in the nuclear posture review is unacceptable, particularly in reference to the idea from the Russians that they thought they'd agreed on a reduction of nuclear weapons, only to find out that this reduction may not mean the same thing in the United States. China says it is deeply shocked at the suggestion that the United States could use nuclear weapons. And I want to turn, if I can, to Jan Lodal on that, whether or not, in reference to what we're reading and hearing and seeing and trying to figure out about this change, whether or not the response from abroad is something that definitely needs to be put into consideration here.
Well, I think it certainly does. We must have cooperation of other nations if we're to win this war on terrorism and stop the spread of weapons of mass destruction. They have legitimate concerns, not only because of what's been focused on so far, which is the, if you will, the way in which nuclear use is planned, but the overall thrust of the nuclear posture review. They had a chance here to follow up on some very good steps the president has taken, to announce that he wants lower numbers, to actually raise the threshold, to move us over a period of a decade or so to what I like to call a non-nuclear relationship with Russia. But it appears they've gone in the opposite direction. Their reductions are no greater than what Clinton had agreed with Russia to do in 1997, and with this focus on the possible first use of nuclear weapons, it really moves us in the opposite direction that we should be going in with regard to our overall nuclear posture.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We're going first to Northborough, Massachusetts. Bill is joining us. Hello, Bill.
Good morning.
Thanks for calling.
I asked your screener the rhetorical question, have we all collectively lost our minds here? I'm listening to this from this weekend on, and I'm wondering if this dream world we're living in, these flights of fancy are totally overwhelming any sense we have of reality here. This makes absolutely no sense, not even slightly. The United States is in the process of preparing itself to make the world more unstable, not more stable. This is insane. This makes the missile defense system, this suggestion that perhaps we might use tactical weapons
But what about the administration's argument that if, in fact, there are states that are building weapons of mass destruction, that perhaps one of the greatest deterrents is to say, okay, now we have a new nuclear missile, which we could send, you know, into your bunker, which is 30 feet underground and shielded by 8 feet of steel, in order to take it out. So don't do it.
First of all, you'd have to have a regime that is bent on committing suicide, because if they had that weapon and if they used it, it would have to be in the complete knowledge that their existence would very shortly cease to exist. It's that simple. No rogue state. If you're going to have a rogue state that's going to do that, even if we didn't have a missile defense system or whatever, there is no way they could not be overwhelmed by us.
Bruce Blair at the Center for Defense Information, the idea that one of these smaller, more precision-guided nuclear missiles would, in fact, be signing this country's death warrant.
Well, let me just say, first of all, that the fact that the United States possesses many, many thousands of nuclear weapons is sufficient cause for pause for any country that might consider attacking us with any kind of a weapon. And it doesn't really matter whether we've designed a more tailored weapon for special purposes or not.
Right.
I think one of the really clear dangers in this process, this trend that's underway of lowering the threshold, and by the way, it's not only the United States, but other countries that are doing this as well, including Russia, which adopted in 1993 a new nuclear policy in which it relies on the early first use of nuclear weapons in a crisis. It previously adhered to a policy of no first use.
With the design and construction of new weapons as a part of that?
No, more as an operational shift in the early 90s.
Right.
It did not pursue new weapons, but it certainly did did lower its nuclear threshold. Other countries have done the same, certainly in South Asia, India, Pakistan, and also China, which are following in the footsteps of Russia and the United States and moving closer to a point at which either a deliberate or accidental war might break out. But one of the real dangers in this policy, as I see it, is that basically we're telling the world that we, the United States, who have enormous power, we are the world's juggernaut. And any number of non-military, not to mention non-nuclear options at our disposal to deal with these threats, chemical and biological and otherwise, that we might have to resort to the use of nuclear weapons. Now, how does the rest of the world perceive that message? They conclude that, well, if the United States can adopt this policy, so can I. And I certainly don't have as many options as the United States. And it's now legitimate for me to think that I may resort to nuclear weapons in response to chemical or biological threats. So there's a war in Iran and Iraq, as there was a decade ago, and chemical weapons are used by Iraq. Iran is justified to use nuclear weapons, or Israel feels threatened by Scud missiles that they believe might have biological warheads, and they feel justified in launching a preemptive nuclear strike, da-da-da-da-da, around the world. This is really probably the most dangerous implication of this new planning logic.
Jan Bill is saying that no nation would, you know, take on a program of the construction of weapons of mass destruction faced with this kind of threat, that it would be suicide. Do you think that that's the way it's seen?
I don't think so. I think that they are trying to develop weapons of mass destruction. Most of the states on this list, most of them would like to have nuclear weapons. We now know that bin Laden wanted nuclear weapons. We know that bin Laden's prepared for suicide. So I think that those aren't really the reasons why this is wrong, if you will. But it is wrong for the reasons that Bruce stated, which is that we have other ways to deal with these, and we have plenty of what's called frequently existential deterrence with all of our existing weapons, and we don't need to move in the direction of more capability. We do need some...
What's an existential deterrent? I'm sorry.
Well, an existential deterrent means that whether we plan specifically to use the weapon in that way or not, if the crisis arose, it's known by everyone that we could rapidly replan the use of some other weapon and that it's perfectly capable of dealing with that kind of a threat. So we don't need to pre-plan all of these kinds of contingencies and announce to the world that nuclear weapons are a major part of how we intend to deal with them, because, as Bruce says, that puts us in exactly the opposite posture from where we should be, which is that nuclear weapons are weapons strictly of last resort, focused on deterrence, and that the world should be reducing them and moving away from emphasis on nuclear weapons, and that we support the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which includes pledges to move in that direction.
Okay, Bill, thanks for your call. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We're going to Millbury, Massachusetts now. Bruce is joining us. Hi, Bruce.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I'm really glad you're doing this show. And I wanted to observe that the use of the word rogue nation makes me cringe because, frankly, I don't see any reason why the rest of the world shouldn't view the United States as a rogue nation in the context of this new, this potential policy. And I'd like to quote Thomas Friedman of the New York Times from a March 12th editorial. He said, "If another country were planning to develop a new nuclear weapon and contemplating preemptive strikes against the list of non-nuclear powers, Washington would rightly label that nation a dangerous rogue state." So why aren't we a rogue state? There you go.
Bruce Blair.
Well, I think that we have indulged ourselves in the arrogance of power. We, as Jan noted earlier, have this preponderance of power that borders on really a supremacy of historical proportions over other countries, both in a nuclear and a non-nuclear terms. And I believe that we are exercising this power in ways to maximize our interest as they are perceived by our own leaders. But I think that it's a misguided path that we have taken to that lowers the threshold for the use of nuclear weapons. It's just a bad policy. And 9/11 drove home the point, if nothing else did. We had 2,000 plus weapons aimed at Russia, ready to be fired in 2 minutes on September 11th, to destroy over 2,000 targets in Russia, which is the requirement of our current strategic war plan. That didn't deter an attack against the United States. And in fact, it was aimed at the wrong country, country that proved to be our primary ally in the war against terrorism. We are spending $30 billion a year on this capability, which is a bit excessive when you compare it to less than $2 billion a year spent on homeland security. We really need to understand also that we had no option to use nuclear weapons in Afghanistan. So they not only, our weapons didn't deter an attack against us, but we couldn't use them in our campaign in Afghanistan. All weapons, all that nuclear weapons represented on September 11th was this acute danger that they might fall into the wrong hands. And the logical conclusion, Dick, here is this. We need leadership in this country to lead us out of the nuclear predicament, raise the nuclear threshold, and move, frankly, toward a nuclear-free world. There was only one really a senior defense official in the last 10 or so years who made any sense on this question, and that was Secretary of Defense Les Aspin, who articulated the view very well that the United States would be far better off in a nuclear-free world, even if that meant giving up our own.
So Jan Lodal, you have actually sat in the chair in the White House talking about defense policy with a number of administrations. Can we look at what we're hearing from the Bush administration now as a form of posturing, as a form of simply taking a stand, a warning, you know, waving the big stick, saying, you know, whether or not we're talking about rogue states or Osama bin Laden's, you know, we got the big toys, don't mess with us, even if it doesn't mean a shift?
Well, I don't think that's what's happened here, knowing the players fairly well who have been involved in the preparation of this document. I think it's been the fact that the president and the vice president and the secretary of defense, secretary of state have been totally focused, national security advisor, totally focused on the terrorism war. They didn't pay attention to some of the details of this nuclear posture review. It's important to remember the president hasn't approved this necessarily. We don't have access to the whole secret report. I suspect that after this plays out, especially given that there's a strong public and international reaction to it, it really won't be so bad. President Bush himself has consistently taken positions that are contrary to the worst case interpretations of this. So I don't think this is his personal view. I think he does want to move the world away from emphasis on nuclear weapons and toward a non-nuclear world. So I think we do have to give a little bit of time here to the administration to sort through this.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Thanks to Bruce for calling. To Norfolk, Virginia now, Monique's joining us. Hi, Monique.
Hello. Good morning.
Hi.
I guess my question is sort of on the same vein, is that isn't it ineffective to target these rogue states when terrorism is multinational and it's a lot of different factions within these states, and doesn't it ultimately just reduce all of this to just posturing? And I'll take my answer off there.
Just before you go, Monique, okay, are you saying that regardless of what the administration is telling Americans at this point, the idea that there would be thousands of warheads is wrong-headed if the new strategy is to use them on a sort of per-occasion basis?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you for your call.
Thanks.
Jan, Bruce, who would like to pick that one up?
Jan. At most, we need a handful of capable weapons to deal with the highly theoretical possibility that we could be facing an imminent attack by weapons of mass destruction that we previously didn't know about. Pre-targeting this, I just don't understand what sense that makes, because we don't have the intelligence to tell us where these weapons are today. And if this absurdly extreme situation were to arise, we would have to have very good and immediate short-term intelligence available to do it. And we have the capabilities to deal with such a situation should it arise. I don't think we should give up those capabilities until the threat of terrorism and the threat of weapons of mass destruction is eliminated, which may be never. But we don't need more plans, more capabilities, new weapons. We need a tiny fraction of the ones we have today to deal with it.
But, Jan, you know that the generals are saying even today that if the technology can be improved, if those weapons, if those nuclear weapons are already the backbone of American defense, maybe they ought to be moved closer to the front line in defense or in combat readiness for the United States.
But I think you heard from both me and Bruce all of the reasons why that would be a disastrous policy for the United States.
Right.
And the generals don't really believe this either. In fact, you'd be hard-pressed to find any general outside of the Strategic Command in Omaha.
So when they're saying it, what are they saying? I mean, is this a make-work project for nuclear scientists who have nothing left to do?
I don't believe the generals are behind this nuclear policy review. I believe these are the defense civilians. And as Bruce said, perhaps one or two flag officers, generals and admirals at Strategic Command believe this. But this is not the way the American military wants to see our posture evolve.
It's a new team of second-tier civilians, largely, who are running this review. The generals themselves have moved far away from any affection for nuclear weapons, except for the one command whose essence is to prepare to fight a large-scale nuclear war, now with Russia currently and possibly in the future with China, and that is the Strategic Command in Omaha, Nebraska. All the other generals have basically washed their hands of nuclear weapons. The Surface Navy was very happy to be rid of them. There are no nuclear weapons in the Army. They're happy to be rid of them. They're Marines. And so it really is just a small cadre of diehards, new civilians in the Bush administration, and a handful of generals that really are driving the policy. And they really can manage to drive it because, as Jan noted, there is kind of a lack of oversight and attention at the highest levels in the government. And this has always been a big problem in this area.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. In this hour, we're talking about nuclear weapons and whether or not the United States is, in fact, significantly changing its policy, whether or not the change is meant to happen so slowly that nobody really particularly notices it, and whether or not maybe it is a different world and a different policy is required. 1-800-423-8255. My name's Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from NPR News. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name is Dick Gordon, and this hour we're talking about what appear to be some fairly significant shifts in this country's nuclear policy. My two guests are Bruce Blair. He's president for the Center for Defense Information. That's an independent military research organization based in Washington, D.C. And Jan Lodal is with us. Jan is author of The Price of Dominance, The New Weapons of Mass Destruction and Their Challenge to American Leadership. Jan, just before we went to the break, you were talking about how the generals aren't really behind this, that it's coming, in fact, from the sort of small civilian cadre of advisors, the Robert Josephs and Stephen Hadleys and Stephen Youngers. But the policy, as it's being explained to Americans, is coming from a former Secretary of Defense, now Vice President Dick Cheney. This man knows what he's talking about. Condoleezza Rice is full face, front on this, saying this is what we're doing. She's national security advisor. The administration seems to be pretty well behind what they're hearing from this small cadre.
Well, we'll see. They certainly haven't backed off completely so far, and I would hope they would. Some of these individuals, such as Steve Hadley, are very familiar with these arguments that we've talked about, and I just don't believe they subscribe to the view that we want to lower the nuclear threshold. I think they do very much subscribe to the view that responding to what you said just before the break, that it is a different world and we do need a new nuclear policy, and particularly with regard to Russia, and we can move away entirely from the first strike kind of an approach that we had in the Cold War. But I think they just haven't had a chance to focus on what that implies. A few hundred nuclear weapons can handle all of these residual nuclear missions for us, including, as I've said, the very, very unlikely but possible case of needing a nuclear weapon to stop a weapon of mass destruction attack on the United States. But this nuclear posture review is just way more. It's come up with way more requirements than can be justified.
1-800, Bruce, quickly.
I was going to say, when they do focus on all this at high levels, I think that they will still find it impossible to reconcile the difference between their political rhetoric and the planning process. This has always been a problem. Condi Rice, for example, pointed out that the most important point of the review is that it downgraded the Russia threat, and she went on to say that Russia is no longer a nuclear enemy of the United States. Well, I agree. But the logical implication of that would be that we should stand down our nuclear forces and no longer prepare to fight a large-scale nuclear war with Russia. But that's not going to happen. That's not going to happen even for a decade. I can guarantee you that the White House will not tell the Strategic Command to stand down its plans to fight a large-scale nuclear war with Russia.
1-800-423-8255. We're going to Hoovelton, New York now, and Carl's calling us. Hi, Carl.
Hello. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
I was contemplating that during the Cold War, we saw the Soviet Union as a rational adversary, although it was abnormal. The United States met that threat with what was thought to be a rational response. Is the same response or formula prudent when we are dealing with a rogue or a madman mentality? Or is the madman really thinking about his people or the children, or is he just thinking about the blood of getting the blood of the enemy, or is that more important?
When you hear the administration, Carl, talking about rogue states, is that your interpretation, that they're talking about the sort of madmen in charge of the weapons and the administrations?
Yes, I definitely think that's generally the mentality, and I think we saw that on 9/11.
Well, what do you think?
Well, I definitely believe that's the case.
Okay. Bruce Blair, maybe you'd just like to see, sort of help us with your understanding on that.
Well, I think we view a number of these countries as not playing by the rules of international law and all the rest, and they certainly don't. And that was the view of the Soviet Union in the 50s. This was a state with very strange behavior, communism and did not adhere to international law and all the rest. And so we, in fact, did not view it as all that rational in the beginning. And that's why we pursued missile defense and air defense and civil defense and all the rest, because we thought that we might really find ourselves in a war with this crazy country. Mm-hmm. And so eventually our view evolved. We were on a learning curve, and we resigned ourselves to thinking of Russia, the Soviet Union, as a rational state because we had to, because we had no other options.
Arms control treaties began. Sitting down and discussing stuff like that.
And we had no other option but to accept the fact that we lived in a state of mutual vulnerability. And so we enshrined that mutual vulnerability as a virtue and said that our security was based on it. But at the same time, we really went fairly bananas in the planning arena. In the 1980s, when you would have thought that we had developed a pretty clear view of Russia and treated it as a rational state, you know how many targets that we planned to destroy in the former Soviet Union in the mid-1980s in a nuclear war?
I have no idea.
16,000. 16,000. Many hundreds of which were in the Moscow area. We even had upwards of 70-some weapons, nuclear weapons, aimed at one single target on the outskirts of Moscow. So the planning system does...
You're saying we weren't that rational on this side of the pond, is what you're saying, right?
When it comes to nuclear weapons, no one is thinking very clearly.
Dick, I certainly agree with that. If I could come in on this briefly, against the irrational actor, there's a role for limited missile defenses. The administration has moved in a direction that's not quite where I would go, but generally all right, in my opinion, in that regard. And beyond that, the most important thing we can do is to develop the kind of coalitions that we're trying to develop against terrorism to support nonproliferation and go against proliferation. The use of offensive nuclear weapons is way down the list, essentially irrelevant to solving this problem.
Carl, back to you. You're a voter. You're a taxpayer. How do you think that this administration should respond to the type of threats that you're describing?
Well, you know, I'm thinking about, you know, not being inflammatory in a sense. I think that, you know, we need to strike back, but this rhetorical discussion or dialogue that's coming from the White House, I think, is counterproductive. And I don't think it sits well or works well with the current mentality that you're dealing with. And I think it sets up more of an inflammatory response as opposed to something productive and rational.
Carl, thanks for your call.
Sure. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Our number's 1-800-423-8255. To Hampton, Virginia now, and Pat's on the line with us. Hello, Pat.
Yes, hello. How are you this afternoon?
Fine. Thanks for calling.
Great. Well, actually, this morning. Sorry about that.
No problem.
What I was thinking about here was the fact that we've got plenty of nukes right now. We've got more than enough needed. We could keep that stuff upgraded. What we really need to concentrate on is immigration in this country. Right now, there is hundreds of thousands of illegal aliens in this country. Our INS, those people are absolutely taxed right now. And we really need to concentrate on the homeland security.
Are you talking about people who would be bringing in sort of terrorist threats or weapons? Are you talking about just keeping people out of the United States?
I'm talking about people that are seated right now that are terrorists that they can't find. There's people running around on expired visas all over the place in this country.
Now, this is a person with a pragmatic, a practical approach to the real problems that we face from weapons of mass destruction. This is the kind of area that we should be focusing on. The high-end preoccupation with nuclear planning, lowering the threshold and all the rest is really misguided and really has no effect whatsoever on our immediate security. And the way out of the predicament, frankly, if I just may interject this, to get escape this impasse on nuclear weapons is to embrace President Putin, who's come a long, long way into the Western orbit and is ready to cooperate with us completely on this counter-terrorist agenda.
You see that relationship at risk with what you're hearing now?
No, I don't. I think that things are really improving in our relations with Russia, but we're not moving fast enough. We should get together with them and really put an end to the nuclear nonsense, stand down these war plans that we continue to play, and frankly, the organizations that continue to play them, the Strategic Command and the Strategic Rocket Forces. We don't need these huge organizations with all these weapons fighting nuclear war plans with each other. We need to really ally ourselves with Russia, and we already have a moral alliance of sorts on counterterrorism, and together, Russia and the United States could handle all of these countries and all of these threats.
Jan Little, Pat's talking about in terms of controlling things on the ground. We know that there are special forces people who already are using their neutron flux detectors and gamma ray detectors. Is that enough, or does there also need to be a larger, broader, longer-term weapons policy that has to be devised at the same time?
Well, of course we need a weapons policy, and it's going to be a decade or so before we and the Russians can move to what I call a non-nuclear relationship. And during that time, there's a residual role for nuclear deterrence. But as Bruce has said, it can be a much reduced posture and footprint, a number of weapons, and raising the threshold and going in the opposite direction. I think, though, that it's important to realize that we can't deal with these kinds of rogue threats, terrorists, rogue states, and so forth, without much better intelligence. A lot of that intelligence has got to come from within the countries where these forces are located. A lot of that means spies. They're not going to be people who grew up in the United States who are able to be these spies. We'll have to recruit locals. And that means cooperation with all of these regimes that are near and around and able to penetrate these organizations. And that should be our focus, is to develop a worldwide consensus. We have a consensus after 9/11 that this has got to be brought under control, and to threaten it by moving in an inflammatory and unnecessary way on nuclear policy is most unfortunate.
Pat, thanks for your call. I'm going to go to Columbia, South Carolina for one more call. And, John, I'll ask you to keep it brief, if you wouldn't mind.
Sure. I keep hearing that we need to tone down our rhetoric, Rick, and personally I think that our administration is the first administration to stand up and just call a spade a spade. That and I just look back to World War II, where people wouldn't confront Hitler, and essentially that's why the state of Israel exists today and a lot of the tension.
And as far as you're concerned, if nuclear first strike weapons are a part of that, then that's okay.
Well, I don't think anybody wants nuclear first strike weapons, but what I take issue with is that people are saying the administration should not be vocal, and I think that they have to lay down the basically the line, and this line can't be crossed, and I fully support that.
Okay, Bruce Blair, we were talking a little earlier about whether or not there's a big distinction between posturing, laying down the line, like John is saying, and being willing to sort of stand up and say this is what it is.
Well, neither Jan Lodahl nor I nor anyone else that I know of would say that there aren't dangers in the world that the Osama and Saddam Hussein and others don't represent a serious threat to our security, but we are saying that we have many, many options for coping with these dangers. And frankly, they're all different countries. Iran is much different from Iraq. We stand a very good chance of having a good relationship with Iran in the fairly short term. And so they're not all spades. There's a spade, there's a club, and a heart, and a diamond in the deck there. And we have to be a little more discriminating in how we understand these countries, their cultural and political character and intentions, and then go from there.
So, Jan, a little less belligerence, a little more finesse?
Well, we could have all the belligerence we feel appropriate against what was done to us on September 11th and against threats of weapons of mass destruction and threats from Iraq and so forth. But it doesn't need to be nuclear belligerence. Nuclear belligerence is counterproductive.
Yeah, the key here is intelligence, as Jan pointed out earlier. And guess who's been our key partner in the hunt for Osama and our counterterrorism campaign in terms of intelligence? It's been Russia. There is so much potential for Russia and the United States to work together to eradicate this problem that it's unbelievable. And that's really the course that we need to be pursuing right now, not to be brandishing nuclear weapons as a threat to these countries.
Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Bruce Blair, president of the Center for Defense Information in Washington, D.C., Jan Lodahl, former principal deputy undersecretary for defense policy during the Clinton administration and author of The Price of Dominance, The New Weapons of Mass Destruction and Their Challenge to American Leadership. We had help producing the program this hour for Kim Bichari, Dara Manoogian, Brian Myers, and Carl Volker. Our program is produced by Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Kelly Jones, Allison McAdam, Lindsay Miller, Tara Murphy, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugarts. Our senior producer is Graham Smith. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.